As it was, the pounding of his heart had become so rapid, it seemed like one steady thrum in his chest by the time David reached the ragged tunnel opening, and his thighs felt like spaghetti. "Don't weaken now," he told himself. "You're into the final straightaway." He made himself move a little faster, suddenly afraid that David might simply turn and go into the shaft before he could get there. It was possible, too. Steve thought the boss knew what was going on, but in fact, the boss knew precious little. He was being handed the script a page ahead of the rest of them. That was all. But David waited, and soon they were all clustered on the slope in front of the opening. A dank smell issued from it, chilly and charred at the same time. And there was a sound Johnny associated with elevator shafts, a faint, windy whisper. "We ought to pray," David said, sounding timid. He held his hands out to either side of him. His father took one of his hands. Steve put down the .30-06 and took the other. Mary took Ralph's, Cynthia took Steve's. Johnny stepped between the two women, dropped the helmet between his boots, and the circle was complete. They stood in the darkness of China Pit, smelling the dank, exhaled breath of the earth, listening to that faint roar, looking at David Carver, who had brought them here. "Whose father?" David asked them. "Our father," Johnny said, stepping easily onto the road of the old prayer, as if he had never been away. "Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come." The others joined in, Cynthia, the minister's daughter, first, Mary last. "Thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen." Through the Amen, Cynthia continued on, "For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen." She looked up with the little twinkle Johnny had come to like quite a lot. "That's the way I learned it. Kind of a Protestant dance mix, you know?" David was looking at Johnny now. "Help me do my best," Johnny said. "If you're there, God, and I now have reason to believe you are, help me do my best and not weaken again. I want you to take that request very seriously because I have a long history of weakening. David, what about you? Anything to say?" David shrugged and shook his head. "Said it already." He let go of the hands holding his, and the circle broke. Johnny nodded. "Okay, let's do it." "Do what?" Mary asked. "Do what? Will you please tell me?" "I'm supposed to go in," David said. "Alone." Johnny shook his head. "Nope. And don't start in with your God told me to stuff, because right now he's not telling you anything. Your TV screen has got a please stand by sign on it. Am I right?" David looked at him uncertainly and wet his lips. Johnny lifted a hand toward the waiting darkness of the drift and spoke in the tone of a man conveying a large favor. "You can go first, though. How's that?" "My dad..." "Right behind you. He'll catch you if you fall." "No," David said. He suddenly looked scared, terrified. "I don't want that. I don't want him in there at all. The roof might cave in, or..."
"David, what you want doesn't matter."
Cynthia grabbed Johnny's arm. She would have been digging into him if she hadn't nibbled her nails to the quick. "Leave him alone. Christ, he saved your fucking life. Can't you quit badgering him?"
"I'm not," Johnny said. "At this point, he's badgering himself. If he'll just let go, remember who's in charge."
He looked at David. The boy muttered something under his breath, far too low to hear, but Johnny didn't have to hear it to know what he had said.
"That's right, he's cruel, but you knew that, and you have no control over the nature of God anyway. None of us do. So why won't you relax?"
David made no reply. His head was bowed, but not in prayer this time. Johnny thought it was resignation.
In some way, the boy knew what was coming, and that was the worst part, the cruelest part, if you liked. "It's not going to be that easy for him," he had told Steve in the Powder magazine. But back there, he hadn't really understood how hard could be. First his sis, then his mother, now... "Right," he said in a voice that sounded as dry as the ground they were standing on. "First David, then Ralph, then you, Steve. I'll be behind you. Tonight, sorry, this morning, it's a case of ladies last. If we have to go in, I want to go in with Steve," Cynthia said. "Okay, fine," Johnny said at once. It was as if he had been expecting this. "You and I can switch places." "Who put you in charge, anyway?" Mary asked. Johnny turned on her like a snake, startling her into a precarious step backward. "Do you want to have a go?" he asked with a kind of dangerous good cheer. "Because if you do, lass, I'd be happy to turn it over to you. I asked for this no more than David did. So what do you think? Want to put him on Big Chief's headdress?" She shook her head, confused. "Easy, boss," Steve murmured. "I'm easy," Johnny said, but he wasn't. He looked at David and his father, standing side by side, heads down, hands entwined, and wasn't easy. He could barely believe the enormity of what he was allowing. Could barely believe? Couldn't believe at all was more like it. How else could he go on, except with merciful incomprehension held before him like a shield? How could anyone? "Want me to take those bags, Johnny?" Cynthia asked timidly. "You still sound pretty much out of breath, and you look all in, if you don't mind me saying." "I'll be fine. It's not far now, is it, David?" "No," David said in a small, trembling voice. He appeared not to be just holding his father's hand now, but caressing it as a lover might do. He looked at Johnny with hopeless, pleading eyes, the eyes of someone who almost knows. Johnny looked away, sick in his stomach, feeling simultaneously hot and cold. He met Steve's bewildered, concerned eyes and tried to send him another message. "Just hold him when the time comes." Out loud, he said, "Give David the flashlight, Steve." For a moment, he didn't think Steve would do it. Then he pulled the flashlight out of his back pocket and handed it over. Johnny lifted his hand to the blackness of the shaft again, toward the dead cold smell of old fire and the faint roaring sound from deep in the middle of the murdered mountain. He listened for some comforting word from Terry, but Terry had split the scene, maybe just as well. "David?" His voice, trembling. "Will you light us on our way?"
"I don't want to," David whispered.
Then, pulling in a deep breath, he looked up at a sky in which the stars were just beginning to pale and screamed, "I don't want to! Haven't I done enough? Everything you asked? This isn't fair! This isn't fair, and I don't want to!" The last four words came out in a desperate, throat-tearing shriek. Mary started forward. Johnny grabbed her arm. "Take your hand off me," she said, and started forward again. Johnny yanked her back again. "Be still." She subsided. Johnny looked at David and silently raised his hand to the drift again. David looked up at his father with tears running down his cheeks.
"Go away, Dad. Go back to the truck."
Ralph shook his head. "If you go in, I go in."
"Don't. I'm telling you, it won't be good for you."
Ralph simply stood his ground and looked patiently at his son. David looked back at him, then at Johnny's outstretched hand, a hand which now did not simply invite but demanded, and then turned and walked into the drift. He clicked on the light as he went, and Johnny saw motes dancing in its bright beam. Motes and something else. Something that might have caused the heart of an old prospector to beat faster. A glint of gold, there and then gone. Ralph followed David,
Steve came next. The light moved in the boy's hand, tracing first along a rock wall, then an ancient support with a trio of symbols carved into it. Some long-dead Chinese miner's name, perhaps, or the name of his sweetheart, left far behind in the marshside huts of Po Yang. And then to the floor, where it picked out a litter of bones, cracked skulls in rib cages that curved like ghastly Cheshire Cat grins. It shifted upward again and to the left. The gold gleam came again, this time brighter and more defined.
"Hey, look out!" Cynthia cried. "Something's in here with us!"
There was a fluttering explosion in the dark. It was a sound Johnny associated with his Connecticut childhood, pheasant exploding out of the underbrush and into the air as twilight drew down toward dark. For a moment, the smell of the mine was stronger, as unseen wings drove the ancient air against his face and pulses. Mary screamed. The flashlight beam jagged upward at an angle, and for just one moment it pinpointed a nightmarish mid-air apparition, something with wings and glaring golden eyes and outstretched talons. It was David the eyes were glaring at. David, it wanted.
"Look out!"
Ralph yelled, and threw himself over David's back, driving him down to the bone-littered floor of the shaft. The flashlight fell from the boy's hand as he went down, kicking up just enough light to be confusing. Unclear shapes strove together in its reflected glow, David under his father, and the shadow of the eagle flexing and swelling above them both.
"Shoot it!" Cynthia screamed. "Steve, shoot it! It's gonna tear his head off!"
Johnny grabbed the barrel of the .30-06 as Steve brought it up. "No, a gunshot'll bring the whole works down on top of us." The eagle screeched, wings battering Carver's head. Ralph tried to fend the bird off with his left hand. It seized one of his fingers in the hook of its beak and tore it off. And then its talons plunged into Ralph Carver's face like strong fingers into dough.
"Daddy, no!"
David shrieked. Steve shoved into the tangle of shadows, and when the side of his foot kicked the down flashlight, Johnny was treated to a better view than he wanted of the bird with Ralph's head in its grip. Its wings sent furious skirls of dust in motion from the floor and the old shaft walls. Ralph's head wagged wildly from side to side, but his body covered David almost completely. Steve drew the rifle back, meaning to swing it, and the butt cracked against the wall. There wasn't room. He jabbed it forward instead, like a lance. The eagle turned its gimlet gaze on him, talons shifting their grip on Ralph. Its wings were soft thunder in the closed space. Johnny saw Ralph's finger jutting from the side of its beak. Steve jabbed forward again, this time catching the eagle squarely and knocking the finger out of the beak. Its head was driven back against the wall. Its talons flexed. One drove deeper into Ralph's face. The other lifted, plunged into his neck, and ripped it open. The bird screamed, perhaps in rage, perhaps in triumph. Mary screamed with it.
"God, no!"
David howled, his voice cracking.
"Oh, God, please make it stop hurting my daddy!"
"This is hell," Johnny thought calmly, stepping forward and then kneeling. He seized the talon buried in Ralph's throat. It was like grabbing some exotically ugly curio which had been upholstered in alligator hide. He twisted it as hard as he could and heard a brittle tearing sound. Above him, Steve drove forward with the stock of the .30-06 again, slamming the eagle's head against the rock side of the shaft. There was a crunch. A wing battered down on Johnny's head. It was like the buzzard in the parking lot all over again. Back to the future, he thought, let go of the talon in favor of the wing, and yanked. The bird came toward him, squalling its ugly ear-splitting cry, and Ralph came with it, pulled by the talon still buried in his cheek, temple, and orbit of his left eye. Johnny thought Ralph was either unconscious or already dead. He hoped he was already dead. David crawled out from under, face dazed, his shirt soaked with his father's blood. In a moment, he would seize the flashlight and plunge deeper into the mine, if they weren't quick. "Steve!" Johnny shouted, reaching blindly over his head and encircling the eagle's back. It plunged and twisted in his hold like the spine of a bucking bronco. "Steve, finish it! Finish it!" Steve drove the stock of the rifle into the bird's gullet, tilting its shadowy head toward the ceiling. At that moment, Mary darted forward. She seized the eagle's neck and wrung it with bitter efficiency. There was a muffled crack, and suddenly the talon buried in Ralph's face relaxed. David's father fell to the floor of the mine, his forehead striking a rib cage and powdering it to dust. David turned, saw his father lying motionless and face down. His eyes cleared. He even nodded as if to say, "Pretty much what I expected," then bent to pick up the flashlight. It was only when Johnny grabbed him around the waist that his calm broke and he began to struggle.
"Let go!" he screamed. "It's my job! Mine!"
"No, David," Johnny said, holding on for dear life. "It's not." He tightened his grip across David's chest with his left hand, wincing as the boy's heels printed fresh pain on his shins, and let his right hand slide down to the boy's hip. From there it moved with a good pickpocket's unobtrusive speed. Johnny took from David what he had been instructed to take, and left something, too.
"He can't take them all and then not let me finish! He can't do that! He can't!"
Johnny winced as one of David's feet connected with his left kneecap. "Steve!" Steve was staring with horrified fascination at the eagle, which was still twitching and slowly fanning one wing. Its talons were red.
"Steve, goddammit!"
He looked up, as if startled out of a dream. Cynthia was kneeling beside Ralph, feeling for a pulse and crying loudly.
"Steve, come here!" Johnny shouted. "Help me!"
Steve came over and grabbed David, who began to struggle even harder.
"No!"
David whipped his head from side to side in a frenzy.
"No! It's my job! It's mine! He can't take them all and leave me! Do you hear? He can't take them all and..."
"David, quit it!" David stopped struggling and merely hung in Steve's arms like a puppet with its strings cut. His eyes were red and raw. Johnny thought he had never seen such desolation and loss in a human face. The motorcycle helmet was lying where Johnny had dropped it when the eagle attacked. He bent, picked it up, and looked at the boy in Steve's arms. Steve looked the way Johnny felt, sick, lost, bewildered. "David," he began.
"Is God in you?" David asked. "Can you feel him in there, Johnny? Like a hand? Or a fire?"
"Yes," Johnny said.
"Then you won't take this wrong."
David spit into his face. It was warm on the skin below Johnny's eyes, like tears. Johnny made no effort to wipe away the boy's spittle. "Listen to me, David. I'm going to tell you something you didn't learn from your minister or your Bible. For all I know, it's a message from God himself. Are you listening?" David only looked at him, saying nothing. "You said God is cruel, the way a person who's lived his whole life on Tahiti might say, 'Snow is cold.' You knew, but you didn't understand." He stepped close to David and put his palms on the boy's cold cheeks. "Do you know how cruel your God can be, David? How fantastically cruel?" David waited, saying nothing. Maybe listening, maybe not. Johnny couldn't tell. "Sometimes he makes us live." Johnny turned, scooped up the flashlight, started down the drift, then turned back once again. "Go to your friend Brian, David. Go to your friend and make him your brother. Then start telling yourself there was an accident out on the highway, a bad one. A no-brain drunk crossed the center line. The RV you were in rolled over and only you survived. It happens all the time. Just read the paper."
"But that's not the truth."
"It might as well be. And when you get back to Ohio or Indiana or wherever it is you hang your hat, pray for God to get you over this, to make you well again. As for now, you're excused.
I'll never say another... What? What did you say?
I said you're excused. Johnny was looking at him fixedly. Excused early. He turned his head. Get him out of here, Stephen. Get them all out of here.
Boss, what?
The tour's over, Tex. Get them into the truck and up the road. If you want to be safe, I'd get going right now. Johnny turned and went jogging down into China Shaft, the light bobbing ahead of him into the black. Soon that was gone, too. 5. He tripped over something in spite of the flashlight, almost went sprawling, and slowed to a walk. The Chinese miners had dropped what stuff they had in their frantic, useless rush to escape, and in the end they had dropped themselves as well. He walked over a littered landscape of bones, powdering them to dust, and moved the light in a steady triangle, left to right, down to the floor, up to the left again, to keep the landscape clear and current in his mind. He saw that the walls fairly jostled with Chinese characters, as if the survivors of the cave-in had succumbed to a sort of writing mania as death first approached and then overtook them. In addition to the bones, he saw tin cups, ancient picks with rusty heads and funny short handles, small rusty boxes on straps, what David had called seeners, he imagined, rotted clothes, deerskin slippers. They were tiny, slippers for infants, one might have thought, and at least 3 pairs of wooden shoes. One of these held the stub of a candle that might have been dipped the year before Abe Lincoln was elected president. And everywhere, everywhere scattered among the remains were cantas, coyotes with spider tongues, spiders with weird albino rattlings poking from their mouths. Spread-winged bats with obscene baby tongues. The babies were leering, gnomish. Some depicted nightmarish creatures that had never existed on the earth, halfling freaks that made Johnny's eyes hurt. He could feel the cantas calling to him, pulling him as the moon pulls its salt water. He had sometimes been pulled in that same way by a sudden craving to take a drink, or to gobble a sweet dessert, or to lick along the smooth velvet lining of a woman's mouth with his tongue. The cantas spoke in tones of madness which he recognized from his own past life, sweetly reasonable voices proposing unspeakable acts. But the cantas would have no power over him unless he stopped and bent and touched them. If he could avoid that, avoid despair that would come disguised as curiosity, he reckoned he would be all right. Had Steve gotten them out yet? He'd have to hope so, and hope that Steve could manage to get them a good distance away in his trusty truck before the end came. A hell of a bang was coming. He only had the 2 bags of Enfo hung around his neck on the knotted drawstrings, but that would be plenty, all they had ever needed. It had seemed wiser not to tell the others that, though. Safer. Now he could hear the soft groaning sound of which David had spoken, the squall and shift of hornfells, as if the very earth were speaking, protesting his intrusion. And now he could see a dim zigzag of red light up ahead, hard to tell how far away in the dark. The smell was stronger, too, and clearer, cold ashes. To his left, a skeleton, probably not Chinese, judging by its size, knelt against the wall as if it had died praying. Abruptly it turned its head and favored Johnny Merrinville with its dead, toothy grin.
Get out while there's still time. Tak Ah Wan. Tak Ah La.
Johnny punted the skull as if it were a football. It disintegrated, almost vaporized, into bone fragments, and he hurried on toward the red light, which was coming through a rift in the wall. The hole looked just big enough for him to squeeze through. He stood outside it, looking into the light, not able to see much from the drift side. hearing David's voice in his head, almost as a trance subject must hear the voice of the hypnotist who has put him under. At 1:10 on the afternoon of September 21st, the guys at the face broke through into what they at first thought was a cave. Johnny tossed the flashlight aside, he wouldn't need it anymore, and squeezed through the gap. As he passed into the Antak, that murmuring elevator sound they had heard at the entrance to the drift seemed to fill his head with whispering voices, enticing, cajoling, forbidding. All around him, turning the Antak chamber into a fantastic hollow column lit in dim scarlet tones, were carved stone faces, wolf and coyote, hawk and eagle, rat and scorpion. From the mouth of each protruded not another animal, but an amorphous reptilian shape Johnny could barely bring himself to look at, and could not really see in any case. Was it Tack? The Tack at the bottom of the inny? Did it matter? How had it gotten Ripton? If it was stuck down there, exactly how had it gotten Ripton? He suddenly realized he was crossing the Antak, walking toward the inny. He tried to stop his legs and discovered he couldn't. He tried to imagine Carrie Ripton making the same discovery and found it was easy. Easy. The long bags of Anfo swung back and forth against his chest. Images danced crazily in his mind. Terry grabbing his belt loops and yanking him tight to her belly as he began to come. The best orgasm of his life, and it had gone nowhere but into his pants. Tell that one to Ernest Hemingway. Coming out of the pool at the Bel Air, laughing, hair plastered to his forehead, holding up the beer bottle as the cameras flashed. Bill Harris telling him that going across country on his motorcycle might change his life and his whole career, if he was really up to it, that was. Last of all, he saw the cop's empty gray eyes staring at him in the rearview mirror, the cop saying he thought Johnny would shortly come to understand a great deal more about Numa, Soma, and Sarx than he had previously. About that, he had been right. God protect me long enough to get this done, he said, and allowed himself to be drawn toward the inny. Could he stop, even if he tried? Best not to know, maybe. There were dead animals lying in a rotting ring around the hole in the floor, David Carver's well of the worlds. Coyotes and buzzards, mostly, but he also saw spiders and a few scorpions. He had an idea that these last protectors had died when the eagle had died. Some withdrawing force had hammered the life out of them, just as the life had been hammered from Audrey Weiler, almost as soon as Steve had slapped the Cantaz out of her hand. Now smoke began to rise out of the inny. Except it wasn't smoke at all, not really. It was some sort of greasy brown-black muck, and as it began to curl toward him, Johnny saw it was alive. It looked like clutching three-fingered hands on the ends of scrawny arms. They were not ectoplasmic, those arms, but neither were they strictly physical. Like the carved shapes looming above and all around him, looking at them made Johnny's head hurt, the way a kid's head hurt when he staggered off some viciously swerving amusement park ride. It was the stuff that had crazed the miners, of course, the stuff that had changed Ripton. The glassless windows of the pier and mall leered at him, telling him, what exactly? He could almost hear. Que demon. Open your mouth. And yes, his mouth was open, wide open, like when you go to the dentist. Please open wide, Mr. Marinville. Open wide, you lousy, contemptible excuse for a writer. You make me furious. You make me sick with rage. But go on. Open wide. Katie Munn, you fucking gray-haired, pretentious motherfucker. We'll fix you up. Make you good as new. Better than new. Open wide. Open wide. Katie Munn, open wide. The smoke. Muck. Whatever it was. Those were no longer hands on the ends of arms, but tubes. No, not tubes.
holes. Yes, that was it. Holes like eyes. Three of them. Maybe more, but three he could see clearly. A triangle of holes, two on top and one underneath. Holes like whispering eyes, like blast holes. That's right, David said. That's right, Johnny. To blast Tack right into you, the way it blasted itself into Carrie Ripton. The only way it has to get out of the hole it's in down there. The hole that's too small for anything but this stuff, this jizz. Two for your nose and one for your mouth. The brownish-black muck twisted toward him, both horrible and enticing. Holes that were mouths, mouths that were eyes, eyes that whispered, promised. He realized he had an erection. Not exactly a great time for one, but when had that ever stopped him? Now, sucking. He could feel them sucking the air out of his mouth, his throat. He snapped his mouth shut and yanked the motorcycle helmet down over his head. He was just in time. A moment later, the brownish ribbons encountered the plexi face shield and spread over it with an unpleasant wet smooching sound. For a moment he could see spreading suckers like kissing lips, and then they were gone, lost in filthy smears of brown particulate matter. Johnny reached out, seized the brown stuff floating before him, and twisted it in opposite directions, as if he were wringing out a face cloth. There was a needling sensation in his palms and fingers, and the flesh went numb. But the brown stuff tore away, some of it drawing back toward the innie, some dripping to the chamber's floor. He reached the edge of the hole, standing between a heap of feathers that had been a buzzard, and a coyote lying dead on its side. He looked down, reaching up to touch the hanging bags of anfo as he did, caressing them with tingling, half-numb hands. "Do you know how to set this shit off without dino or blasting caps?" Steve had asked. "You do, don't you? Or you think you do?" "I hope I do," Johnny said. His voice was flat and strange inside the helmet. "I hope I..."
"Then come on," a mad voice cried out from below him.
Johnny recoiled in terror and surprise. It was the voice of the cop, of Collie and Trajan.
"Come on, Tak-a-la, Pirin Maw. Come on, you rotten cocksucker. Let's see how brave you are. Tack!"
He tried to take a step backward, maybe think this over, but tendrils of muck curled around his ankles like hands and jerked his feet out from under him. He went into the well in a graceless, feet-first dive, hammering the back of his head against the edge as he fell. If not for the helmet, his skull would likely have been crushed in. He curled the bags of anfo protectively against his chest, making breasts of them. Then the pain came, first biting, then searing, then seeming to eat him alive. The innie was funnel-shaped, but the descending, narrowing circle was lined with crystal outcrops of quartz and cracked hornfels. Johnny slid down this like a kid down a slide that has grown crooked glass thorns. His legs were protected to some degree by the leather shafts, and his head was protected by the motorcycle helmet, but his back and buttocks were shredded in moments. He put down his forearms in an effort to break his slide. Needles of stone tore through them. He saw his shirt sleeves turn red. An instant later, they were in ribbons.
"You like that?"
the voice from the bottom of the innie jibed, and now it was Ellen Carver's voice.
"Tak Allah, you interfering bastard! En to, ten Allah!"
Raving, cursing him in two languages. Insane in any dimension, Johnny thought, and laughed in his agony. He lurched forward, meaning to somersault or die trying. Time to tenderize the other side, he thought, and laughed harder than ever. He could feel blood pouring into his boots like warm water. The brown-black vapor was all around him, whispering and smearing gaping sucker mouths across the helmet's faceplate. They appeared, disappeared, then appeared again, rubbing and making those low, suggestive smooching sounds. He couldn't get off his back the way he wanted to, couldn't somersault. The angle of descent was too steep. He turned over on his side instead, clutching at the crystal outcrops that were tearing him open, slashing his hands and not caring, needing to stop himself before he was literally cut to ribbons. Then, suddenly, it was over. He lay folded at the bottom of the funnel, bleeding everywhere, it felt like, his slit nerves trying to drown out all rational thought with their mindless screaming. He looked up and saw a wide swath of blood marking his path down the inclined, curving wall. Strips of cloth and leather, his shirt, his Levi's, his chaps, hung from some of the jutting crystals. Smoke curling up between his legs, coming from the hole at the bottom of the funnel and trying to seize his crotch. "Let go," he said. "My God commands it." The brownish-black smoke fell back, curling around his thighs in filthy banners. "I can let you live," a voice said. It was no wonder, Johnny thought, that Tack was caught on the other side of the funnel. The hole to which it narrowed was stringent, no more than an inch across. Red light pulsed in it like a wink. "I can heal you, make you well, let you live." "Yeah, but can you win me a goddamn Nobel Prize for literature?" Johnny slipped the bags of Anfo off his neck, then yanked the hammer from his belt. He'd have to work fast. He was cut in what felt like a billion places, and already he could feel the grayness of blood loss crowding in on his mind. It made him think of Connecticut again, and the way the fogs came in after dark during the last weeks of March and the first weeks of April. The old-timers called it Strawberry Spring. God knew why. "Yes. Yes, I can do that." The voice from the narrow red throat sounded eager. It also sounded frightened. "Anything. Success, money, women, and I can heal you. Don't forget that. I can heal you." "Can you bring David's father back?" Silence from the innie. Now the brownish-black mist coming out of the hole found the long confusion of slashes along his back and legs, and suddenly Johnny felt as if he had been attacked by moray eels, or piranhas. He screamed. "I can make the pain stop," Tack said from its tiny hole. "All you have to do is ask, and stop yourself, of course." With sweat stinging his eyes, Johnny used the claw end of the hammer to tear open one of the Anfo bags. He tilted the slit over the tiny hole, spread the cloth, and poured through one cupped, bloody hand. The red light was obliterated at once, as if the thing down there feared it might inadvertently set off the charge itself. "You can't!" it screamed, its voice muffled now, but Johnny heard it clearly enough in his head, just the same. "You can't, damn you! An la! An la! Os damn, you bastard!" "An la yourself," Johnny thought, "and a big fat candy latch in the bargain." The first bag was empty. Johnny could see dim whiteness in the hole where there had been only black and pulsing red light before. The gullet leading back to Tack's world, or plane, or dimension. Wasn't that long, then, not in physical terms of measurement. And was the pain in his back and legs less? "Maybe I've just gone numb," he thought. "Not a new state for me, actually." He grabbed the second bag of Anfo and saw one entire side of it was sopped through with his blood. He felt a growing weakness to go along with the fog in his head. Had to be quick now. Had to go like the wind. He tore open the second bag with the hammer's claw, trying to steel himself against the shrieks in his head. Tack had lapsed entirely into that other language now. He turned the bag over the hole and watched Anfo pellets pour out. The whiteness grew brighter as the gullet filled. By the time the bag was empty, the top layer of pellets was only 3 inches or so down. Just room enough, Johnny thought. He became aware that a stillness had fallen here in the well, and in the Antak above. There was only that faint whispering, which could have been the calling of ghosts that had been penned up in here ever since the 21st of September, 1859. If so, he intended to give them their parole. He fumbled in the pocket of his chaps for what seemed to be an age, fighting the fog that wanted to blur his thoughts, fighting his own growing weakness. At last his fingers touched something, slipped away, came back, touched it again, grasped it, brought it out. A fat, green shotgun shell. Johnny slipped it into the eye hole at the bottom of the innie, and wasn't surprised to find it was a perfect fit, its blunt circular top seated firmly against the Enfo pellets.
"You're primed, you bastard," he croaked.
"No,"
a voice whispered in his head.
"No, you dare not."
Johnny looked at the brass circlet plugging the hole at the bottom of the innie. He gripped the handle of the hammer, his strength flagging badly now, and thought of what the cop had told him just before he stuck him in the back of the cruiser. "You're a sorry excuse for a writer," the cop had said. "You're a sorry excuse for a man, too." Johnny shoved the helmet off with the heel of his free left hand. He was laughing again as he raised the hammer high above his head, and laughing as he brought it down squarely on the base of the shell. "God forgive me, I hate critics." He had one fraction of a moment to wonder if he had succeeded, and then the question was answered in a bloom of brilliant, soundless red. It was like swooning into a rose. Johnny Marinville let himself fall, and his last thoughts were of David. Had David gotten out? Had David gotten clear? Was he all right now? Would he be all right later? "Excused early," Johnny thought. And then that was gone, too. Part 5. Highway 50. Excused Early. 1. There were dead animals lying in a rough ring around the truck, buzzards and coyotes mostly, but Steve barely noticed them. He was all but eaten alive with a need to get out of here. The steep sides of the China pit seemed to loom over him like the sides of an open grave. He reached the truck a little ahead of the others. Cynthia and Mary were flanking David, each of them holding one of the boy's arms, although he did not seem to be staggering, and tore open the passenger door. "Steve, what?" Cynthia began. "Get in. Ask questions later." He butt-boosted her up into the seat. "Push over. Make room." She did. Steve turned to David. "Are you going to be a problem?" David shook his head. His eyes were dull and apathetic, but that didn't completely convince Steve. The boy was nothing if not resourceful. He had proved that before he and Cynthia ever met him. He boosted David into the truck, then looked at Mary. "Get in. We'll have to bundle a little, but if we're not friends by now..." She scrambled into the cab and closed the door as Steve hurried around the front of the truck, stepping on a buzzard as he went. It was like stepping on a pillowcase stuffed with bones. How long had the boss been gone? A minute? Two? He had no idea. Any sense of time he might once have had was completely shot. He swung into the driver's seat and allowed himself just one moment to wonder what they'd do if the engine wouldn't start. The answer, nothing, came at once. He nodded at it, turned the key, and the engine roared to life. No suspense there, thank God. A second later, they were rolling. He turned the rider truck in a big circle, skirting the heavy machinery, the powder magazine, and the field office. Between these latter two buildings was the dusty police cruiser, driver's door open, front seat area plastered with Collie and Trajan's blood. Looking at it, into it, made Steve feel cold and a little dizzy, the way he felt when he looked down from a tall building. "Fuck you," Mary said softly, turning to look back at the car. "Fuck you, and I hope you hear me." They hit a bump, and the truck rattled terrifically. Steve flew up and off the seat, his thighs biting into the bottom arc of the steering wheel, his head bumping the ceiling. He heard a muffled clatter as the stuff in the back flew around. The boss's stuff, mostly.
"Hey,"
Cynthia said nervously. Don't you think you got the hammer a little too far down for Rock Top, big boy?
No, Steve said. He looked into the mirror outside his window as they began tearing up the gravel road which led to the rim of the pit. It was the drift opening he was looking for, but he couldn't see it. It was on the other side of the truck. About halfway to the rim, they hit another bump, a bigger one, and the truck actually seemed to leave the road for an instant or two. The headlights corkscrewed, then dipped as the truck dove deep on its springs. Both Mary and Cynthia screamed. David did not. He sat crooked between them, a life-sized doll, half on the seat and half in Mary's lap.
"Slow down," Mary screamed. "If you go off the road, we'll go all the way to the bottom. Slow down, you asshole."
"No," he repeated, not bothering to add that going off this road, which was as wide as a California freeway, was the least of his worries. He could see the pit rim ahead. The sky above it was now a dark, brightening violet instead of black. He looked past the others and into the mirror outside the passenger window, searching for the dark mouth of the tunnel in the darker well of the China pit, Can Tak and Can Ta, and then didn't have to bother. A square of white light, too brilliant to look at, suddenly lit up the pit floor. It lashed out of the China shaft like a burning fist and filled the cab of the truck with savage brilliance.
"Jesus, what's that?"
Mary screamed, throwing a hand up to shield her eyes.
"The boss," Steve said softly.
A heavy thud seemed to run directly beneath them, a muffled battering ram of sound. The truck began to shiver like a frightened dog. Steve heard broken rock and gravel begin to slide. He looked out his window and saw, in the dying glare of the blast, black nets of PVC pipe, emitters and distribution heads, sliding down the pit face. The porphyry was in motion. China Pit was falling in on itself.
"Oh, my God, we're going to be buried alive," Cynthia moaned.
"Well, let's see," Steve said. "Hang on."
He jammed the gas pedal to the floor. It didn't have far to go, either. And the truck's engine responded with an angry scream.
"Almost there, honey," he thought at it. "Almost there. Come on. Work with me, beautiful. Be there for me."
That battering ram rumble went on and on beneath them, seeming at one moment to fade, then coming back like a wave form. As they reached the rim of the pit, Steve saw a boulder the size of a gas station go bouncing down the slope on their right. And, more ominous than the rumble from below them, he heard a growing whisper from directly beneath them. It was, Steve knew, the gravel surface of the road. The truck was northbound. The road was headed south. In only a few moments, it would collapse down into the pit like a dropped carpet runner.
"Run, you bitch!" he screamed, pounding on the wheel with his left fist. "Run for me! Now! Now!"
The Ryder truck surged over the rim of the pit like a clumsy, yellow-nosed dinosaur. For a moment, the issue was still in doubt, as the crumbled earth under the rear wheels ran out and the truck wallowed first sideways and then backwards.
"Go!" Cynthia screamed. She sat forward, clutching the dashboard. "Oh, please go! For God's sake, get us out of here!"
She was thrown back in the seat as the wheels found purchase again. Just enough. For a moment, the headlights went on stabbing at the lightening sky, and then they were rushing across the rim, headed north. From behind them, out of the pit, rose an endless flume of dust, as if the earlier freak storm had started up all over again, only confined to this one location. It rose in the sky like a pyre. 2. The trip down the north side of the embankment was less adventurous. By the time they were running across the 2 miles of desert between the pit and the town, the sky in the east was a bright salmon pink. And, as they passed the bodega with a fallen sign, the sun's upper arc broke over the horizon. Steve jammed on the brakes just past the bodega at the south end of Desperation's Main Street. Holy shit, Cynthia murmured in a low voice. Mother McCree, Mary said, and put a hand to her temple as if her head hurt. Steve could say nothing at all. Until now, he and Cynthia had only seen desperation in the dark or through veils of blowing sand, and what they had seen had been glimpsed in frantic little snatches, their perceptions honed to a narrow focus by the mortal simplicities of survival. When you were trying to stay alive, you just saw what you had to see. The rest went by the board. Now, however, he was seeing it all. The wide street was empty except for one lazily blowing tumbleweed. The sidewalks were drifted deep with sand, drifted completely under in places. Broken window glass twinkled here and there. Trash had blown everywhere. Signs had fallen down. Power lines lay snarled in the street like broken distributor heads. And the American West's marquee now lay in the street like a grand old yacht that has finally gone on the rocks. The one remaining letter, a large black R, had finally fallen off. And everywhere there were dead animals, as if some lethal chemical spill had taken place. He saw scores of coyotes, and from the doorway of Bud's Suds there ran a long, curving pigtail of dead rats, some half covered with the sand skirling about in a light morning breeze. Dead scorpions lay on the fallen leprechaun weather vane. They looked to Steve like shipwreck survivors who had died badly on a barren island. Buzzards lay in the street and on the roofs like dropped heaps of soot. "And thou shalt set bounds unto the people round about," David said. His voice was dead, expressionless. "And you shall say, take heed to yourselves that you should not go up into the mount." Steve looked into his rearview mirror, saw the embankment of the China Pit looming against the brightening sky, saw the dust still pouring out of its sterile caldera, and shuddered. "Go not up into the mount, or touch the border of it. Whosoever toucheth the mount shall surely be put to death. There shall not be a hand touch it, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through. Whether it be beast or man, it shall not live." The boy looked up at Mary, and his face began to shiver apart and become human. His eyes filled with tears. "David," she began, "I'm alone. Do you get it? We came upon the mountain and God slaughtered them all, my family. Now I'm alone." She put her arms around him and pressed his face against her. "Say, Chief," Cynthia said, and put a hand on Steve's arm, "let's blow this shithole of a town and find us a cold beer. What do you say?" 3. Highway 50 again. "Down this way," Mary said. "We're close now." They had passed the Carver's RV. David had turned his face against Mary's breasts again as they approached it, and she put her arms around his head and held him. For almost 5 minutes he didn't move, didn't even seem to breathe. The only way she could tell for sure that he was alive was by the feel of his tears, slow and hot, wetting her shirt. In a way, she was glad to feel them, thought them a good sign. The storm had also struck the highway, she saw. Sand covered it completely in places, and Steve had to wallow the rider truck through several drifts in low gear. "Would they have closed it?" Cynthia asked Steve once. "The cops? Nevada Public Works? Whatever?" He shook his head. "Probably not, but you can bet there wasn't much of anyone out last night. Lots of interstate truckers holed up in Ely and Austin." "There it is," Mary cried, and pointed at a sun star twinkling about a mile ahead of them. 3 minutes later, they were pulling up to Deirdre's Acura. "Do you want to come in the car with me, David?" she asked, "assuming the damn thing will even start, that is." David shrugged. "The cop let you keep your keys?" Cynthia asked. "No, but if I'm lucky..." She hopped out of the truck, landed in a loose dune of sand, and made her way to the car. Looking at it brought Peter back in a rush. Peter, who had been so goddamned absurdly proud of his James Dickey monograph, never guessing that the planned follow-up wasn't going to happen. The car doubled in her sight, then blurred into prisms. Chest hitching, she wiped an arm across her eyes, then knelt and felt around under the front bumper. At first, she couldn't find what she was looking for, and it all seemed like too much. Why did she want to follow the Ryder truck to Austin in this car anyway, surrounded by memories? By Peter. She laid her cheek against the bumper. Soon it would be too hot to touch, but for now it was still night cool, and let herself cry. She felt a hand touch hers, tentatively, and looked around. David was standing there, his gaunt, too old face hanging over a slim boy's chest in a blood-stained baseball T-shirt. He looked at her solemnly, not quite holding her hand, but touching her fingers with his, as if he would like to hold it. "What's wrong, Mary?" "I can't find the little box," she said, and pulled in a large, watery sniff. "The little magnetic box with the spare key in it. It was under the front bumper, but I guess it must have fallen off. Or maybe the boys who took our license plate took that, too." Her mouth twisted, and she began to cry again. He dropped to his knees beside her, wincing as something pulled in his back. She saw, even through her tears, the bruises on his throat where Audrey had tried to choke him. Ugly black-purple blotches like thunderheads. "Shh, Mary," he said, and felt along the inside of the bumper with his own hand. She could hear his fingers fluttering in that darkness and suddenly wanted to cry out, "Be careful! There might be spiders! Spiders!" Then he showed her a small gray box. "Give it a shot, why don't you? If it doesn't start..." He shrugged to show it didn't matter much one way or the other. There was always the truck. Yes, always the truck. Except Peter had never ridden in the truck, and maybe she did want the smell of him a little longer, the feel of him. "That's a nice set of cantaloupes, ma'am," he'd said, and then touched her breast. The memory of his smell, his touch, his voice, the glasses he wore when he drove. Those things would hurt, but... "Yeah, I'll come with you," David said. They were kneeling in front of Deirdre Finney's car, facing each other that way. "If it starts, that is. And if you want..." "Yes," she said. "I do want." 4. Steve and Cynthia joined them, helping them to their feet. "I feel like I'm 108," Mary said.
"Don't worry, you don't look a day over 89," Steve said, and smiled when she made as if to pop him one. "Do you really want to try making Austin in that little car? What if it gets stuck in the sand?"
"One thing at a time. We're not even sure it'll start, are we, David?" "No," David said in a kind of sigh. He was going away from her again. Mary could feel it, but she didn't know what to do about it. He stood with his head bent, looking at the Acura's grill as if all the secrets of life and death were there, the emotion draining out of his face again, leaving it distant and thoughtful. One hand was wrapped loosely around the gray metal Magna Cube with the spare key in it. "If it does start, we'll caravan," she told Steve. "Me behind you. If I get stuck, we'll hop into the truck. I don't think we will, though. It isn't such a bad car, actually. If my goddamn sister-in-law just hadn't used it as a dope stash..." Her voice trembled, and she closed her lips tightly. "I don't think we'll have to go far to get in the clear," David said, without looking up from the Acura's grill. 30 miles? 40? Then open road." Mary smiled at him. "I hope you're right." "There's a slightly more important question," Cynthia said. "What are we going to tell the police about all this? The real police, I mean." No one said anything for a moment. Then David, still looking at the grill of the Acura, said, "The front part. Let them figure out the rest for themselves." "I don't get you," Mary said. She actually thought she did, but wanted to keep him talking. Wanted him out here with the rest of them mentally as well as physically.
I'll tell about how we had flat tires and the bad cop took us back to town. How he got us to go with him by saying there was a guy out in the desert with a rifle. Mary, you tell